I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. There's a new album that celebrates the contributions of Jewish songwriters to the sound and ethos of the Broadway musical, A Place for Us, a Celebration of Jewish Broadway. Ari Axelrod, the acclaimed award-winning musical storyteller, joins me now to talk about this album that features his vocals, a 13-piece orchestra, and very fine orchestrations by Mike Stapleton, of songs by a myriad of composers, Cole Porter, Stephen Sondheim, Rodgers and Hammerstein, Mary Rodgers, Bach and Harnick, Jerry Herman, Stephen Schwartz, the Gershwins, Jason Robert Brown, Adam Gittell, among others. The music covered in the album range from memorable show tunes we can all hum to lesser-known works. There are also contemporary works, as well as songs that go back to the earlier parts of the 20th century, even folk and traditional music. It's such a rich legacy, and Mr. Axelrod, who joined me last week, lauds the source material, as well as notes the Jewish influence in the words and music that's presented so lovingly on the album, which is available this Friday from PS Classics. There'll be a release concert this Saturday night at New York's famed 54 Below, and if you're not able to make it to Manhattan, the event will be available for streaming. Visit 54below.org for tickets and information. Ari Axelrod's award-winning show, A Place for Us, a Celebration of Jewish Broadway, which is the basis of this album, has been performed to sold-out audiences around the world. He is the recipient of a 36 to Watch Award from Jewish Week, a 2022 Bistro Award, and the Julie Wilson Award from the Mabel Mercer Foundation. Visit AriAxelrod.com for more information. We had done a version of the interview you're about to hear in late December, but because of technical issues at my end, the tape was lost. I thank Ari and his publicist, Dan Fortune, for making the time to do it again, as it were. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Ari Axelrod. Mr. Axelrod, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us again. I'll explain in the introduction why we're doing this again, and I so appreciate you indulging me in another conversation, because I enjoyed what we did, and
course.
What was lost. This album, A Place for Us, a Celebration of Jewish Broadway, I listened to it. The file that I got from your publicist was one whole, I don't know how long the album runs, it's over an hour, I think, one clip. And so I listened to it like...
one sequence.
Yeah, so I listened to it like that. And I can't tell you... advising people that they should listen to albums from the way that the artist put it together, because it does make sense, doesn't it? And it does take time for you to figure out where to place things and the order that things go. I mean, you do spend a lot of time on things like that, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everything is intentional. Everything.
And that's the great thing, too, is that you're able to take songs that we're familiar with songs that we may not be familiar with, and you put it together. It's just a marvelous showcase. It becomes a piece in itself of this wonderful music. I'm sure the album could have been twice the size, or even, you know, three times the size that it is. How do you go about selecting what you want to select and what you want to showcase, say?
Sure. Well, I'll start by saying that, you know, the album is a companion piece to the one-man show that I do called A Place for Us, a Celebration of Jewish Broadway. And, you know, it is not meant to be, you know, the sonic experience of seeing the show. It is meant to be a companion piece to the show. So the hope is that the album brings people to the show and that the show brings people to the album. But we knew that we wanted to highlight the songs that we do in the show. But there are songs in the show that aren't on the album, and there are songs on the album that aren't in the show. So it really became about, you know, what are we trying to say with this album? What are we wanting to have the listener feel and experience? And really, I mean, we could have picked any number of composers, any number of songs, but it really was about, you know, being a companion piece for the show. So we took a lot of the material from the show. But the thing that made it interesting is the show has a script. I speak a lot in the show. Mm. And on the album, I don't say a single word. So our work was cut out for us in terms of figuring out how can we effectively convey what we want to convey without saying a single word. And that was actually the more interesting creative part of the process than picking the songs we wanted. I'd like to believe that we were quite successful in saying the things you wanted to say without saying a word at all.
Indeed, you do, because you hear the listener hears what you want to say just in the selection of the songs. You know, I understand, Ari, that you've started doing that show since 2018. And from 2018 to now 2025, some of these songs have taken on new meaning for you personally, haven't they?
Absolutely. You know, when I first did the show, I was invited to Eastern Michigan University by the then head of the Jewish Studies Department, Marty Schickman. And the show really was an academic lecture with music.
Right.
And that was October 6th, 2018, and the world looked very different for Jews then. I mean, yes, we'd had Charlottesville, and we saw a rise in anti-Semitism from you know, white supremacists on the far right. But then 3 weeks later was the Tree of Life shooting in Pittsburgh. And that really felt like the beginning of a new era for Jews, at least Jews in America. And every time I've done the show since 2018, there has been something else that has gone on, that people come up to me in the audience and they say, thank you so much. We need this show now more than ever. And I thought, yes, but what makes this now more important than the now 5 months ago? And then October 7th happened, and I agreed with the audience that we need this show, and I need this show now more than ever. I need this reminder that, you know, this is what we give to the world. This is a Jewish legacy. This Broadway art form is a Jewish legacy. And now when you look at the news, you know, or even just in common conversations, you hear the word Judaism, and the first thing that comes to people's mind is anti-Semitism. Mm. And anti-Semitism is not a Jewish thing. Judaism is a Jewish thing. And while it is important to know what you're fighting against, I believe it is more important to know what you're fighting for. And for me, this show is a celebration of what we're fighting for. We're fighting for Jewish expression, for Jewish vitality, and for Jewish culture. And while some songs have, you know, stayed the same and the arrangements are the same, or the arrangement isn't different than what it is, you know, in the original musical that it's from, many of the songs we've had to shift the arrangement in order to more appropriately and accurately capture the tone of the world that we live in.
And so I'm sure, you know, people listening to this understand that, and obviously people that go see you feel, you know, go through a myriad of feelings as they're listening to you in the context that they're sitting in a room in. But for you as a performer, I mean, all these themes, immigration, assimilation, activism, faith, and family, you feel those. And I'm wondering, what is it like for you as a performer to have to bear those every night, knowing that you're performing in a room, in a city, in a country, that's the way it is at the moment?
You know, I find it to be just an incredible honor, because, you know, I tell the story in the show, but, you know, it's not on the album. My great-great-uncle was an opera singer in Kiev during the Second World War. And in the middle of a performance, the Nazis entered the opera company in the middle of a show, and they stopped the show, and they separated Jews and non-Jews, and they had the Jews line up in a single-file line, and they murdered them all by firing squad, including my great-great-uncle. So when I'm on stage, and I tell the story, and I say, you know, one of the last things that my great-great-uncle saw was an audience of people staring back at him as he sang. It's exactly what I see as I look out on all of you right now. And when I sing for all the notes that he didn't get to sing. My voice is his voice. So for me, even when it costs me something, and doing the show very rarely costs me something, it's actually quite invigorating to do it and sustaining. Mm-hmm. It gives me a place to put my anger, and it gives me a place to put my love and my passion and my all the emotions that I feel as a Jew in the world today. But I'm able to do it. And that, to me, is reason enough to do it. Because I come from a line of ancestors who, for whatever reason, in whatever era they lived in whatever corner of the world they lived in, they didn't have the privileges that I have. They didn't have the ability to do it. And so for me, because I have the ability, and because I have the privilege and the freedom and the right enough to do it, that's reason enough to do it. And just being able to honor them, to honor their legacy, that to me makes it so much bigger than myself. And so it's the show isn't really, it's not about me. It's not, yes, I'm the only one up there, like me and the brilliant orchestra.
Mm.
But it's about the composers. It's about the audience. It's about the world. It's about the people who came before us. I just happen to be the one up there speaking and singing, but it's not about me. So I've never thought of it as being something that costs me anything personally, because it's bigger than me.
The album has a marvelous diversity of Broadway, both the classic, you know, songs that we're familiar with, and then songs that we're not so familiar with. You know, a lot of these contemporary pieces are just marvelous for us to hear some of them for the first time. The thing that strikes me as I look back at the material that you're performing on this album is that they're not performed in the context of the shows that they appear in, and so they do take on new meaning, don't they? They also show just a marvelous diversity of Broadway. We think of Broadway as just show tunes, and a lot of it can be, but you take some marvelous songs that we all know, and the way that they're arranged on this album, they take on this new thing, and I guess that's what's so vital and marvelous about this material, is that it has this robustness, if you will, that it can be performed for enjoyment, but it takes on some marvelous, profound meaning, doesn't it?
It does. It does. You know, one of the things that has been very important to me about doing this show and also the creation of this album is that hopefully this album will be around for many years. That hopefully people will listen to this album long after I'm gone. And that hopefully these songs will continue to meet the listener where they're at. That what's contemporary today might not be contemporary 50 years from now. There was a time when Some Enchanted Evening was the hottest song in America. Now it's a, you know, classic. But the hope is that the message of the songs, the intention behind the songs, will continue to meet the listener where they're at, wherever and whenever they are.
Yeah, you know, as a non-Jew living in Vancouver, one understands, you know, obviously what these songs mean, in the context that they were, say, created in, as well as the context of today, and how relevant they are, and how necessary they are for audiences today. You take a marvelous song like You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To, which is a song that we all know that we love. And you pair that with a traditional song, and I'm going to let you pronounce the name of it because I'm going to probably not do it justice.
Papi Russin.
Papi Russin. When you, how do you decide that those two songs say are so well matched and that need to be put together, Sam?
There is this incredible documentary about, it's a PBS documentary about the Jewish influence on musical theater, and Justin is at the piano and he's talking about You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To, and he draws a comparison to a different Yiddish song. And for the longest time, I thought that that was, you know, the connective tissue. And then I was asked to sing in a concert a couple years ago an English translation of Papi Russin. I'd never heard it before. I didn't know that it was such an iconic Yiddish song. And I told my bubby that I was singing this song, and she said, every time I hear that song, it makes me weepy. She said, my dad used to sing it. My mom used to sing it. It is one of my grandmother's most beloved songs. And once I heard Tupichakoyf, Shakoyf, Shapapi Rosin, I drew another comparison to You'd Be So Nice to Come Home To. But the idea that that song was in any way informed by Yiddish music was originally presented by, you know, Mori Yestin in that brilliant documentary. But presenting the connective tissue to Papi Russin really just dawned on me one day. And I'm not to say that I'm the first one to do it. I'm sure there are people who've come before me who've made that comparison. But in my mind, I heard it one day, and I thought, oh my God, wow, look at Cole Porter. I mean, I know that he did this on purpose, but did he know that he was borrowing from multiple Jewish songs when he wrote this melody? Who knows?
Yeah. You know, you do a number of songs, three songs actually, from Milk and Honey, the Jerry Herman show. You know, those are songs that I've heard that they're just so pleasant to listen to. But when you slow them down as you do on this album, They take on just a profundity that I don't think even Herman might have even conceived of.
Right.
It's such rich material in those three songs. What are some things that you're thinking about as you're singing those, say?
Well, you know, in the show, which, you know, you can't do on the album, but in the show, I talk about how I did a revival of Milk and Honey off Broadway several years ago, and on opening night we got a call from Jerry Herman, and he left us a voicemail wishing us a happy opening, and I play the voicemail in the show, but when I sing it, I think about that voicemail. I think about that experience of doing the show, but I also think about Israel. And I think about how that show was written in 1961, and that was a very, very different Israel and a very different world and perception of Israel then than it is now. And it makes me sad. It breaks my heart that this place, you know, this is the place where the hopes of the homeless and the dreams of the lost combine. In 1961, it was, what, 16 years after the Holocaust that he wrote these lyrics? And the majority of the Israeli population in 1961 was comprised of refugees from the Middle East who were ethnically cleansed from Yemen and Morocco and Tunisia and Algeria and Libya and Syria and Iraq and Iran, who were forced out of their homes and had only one place to go, and that was Israel. And I think of the Holocaust survivors who really could either go to North America or Israel. And so the lyric, this is the place where the hopes of the homeless and the dreams of the lost combine, that to me perfectly summarizes what Israel was at that moment. And unfortunately, in the wake of October 7th, and as we're seeing fewer and fewer places become safe for Jews, it feels like we are reverting back to a necessity for Jews to have a place to go, and it just breaks my heart. It just breaks my heart.
Yeah, I went back to listen to the original cast album of Milk and Honey after I heard your album, and it really struck me that this optimism that's there, and you know, considering you know what it was like in the '60s, and that optimism I think is still there for a lot of people, but it's very different in 2025, and you're right, one does feel the you know, you can hear the heartbreak even in the song itself, and in the way you perform it on this album. That comes through, and I can just imagine what that's like as a member of the audience. And so you'll be at 54 Below on the 18th.
Yes, but we're live streaming, so you can watch it from anywhere.
Or anywhere around the world, yeah. What goes on as you could, because this is the launch of a place for us at 54 Below. You probably can't do the full album in that show. So what goes on in terms of how do you pick what you're going to perform, say, that night?
You know, for that performance in particular. You know, I say that the album is a companion piece for the show, and we want to give people a taste of what it feels like to be in the room. But for that night, we'll have people in the room. So I'm basically saying tonight we are doing the show. We're doing the show, but we're doing some songs that are on the album that aren't in the show, and we're going to do some of the arrangements that are on the album, but we're going to basically do the show as it is, and then hopefully people will leave and then go listen to the album, and it will remind them of what it felt like to be in the room.
Will you have all 13 pieces of the orchestra on stage with you there?
No, God, no. I wish. No, we will have piano, bass, drums, cello, violin, and woodwinds.
On the album, you take Sondheim's Children Will Listen, and it comes after Rodgers and Hammerstein's You've Got to Be Carefully Taught. It's such a moving piece, hearing those two songs together, because we get we understand just how important the role we as adults play in the lives of young people, and it takes both perspectives, if you will, of that concept.
Yeah.
In both songs, it's also a marvelous showcase of the heritage of Broadway, because you know this is a song from the 40s, I think. And then Children Will Listen comes from the 80s, and yet, you know, the heritage of Broadway is put together because, as I think a lot of us know, Sondheim was a protege of Oscar Hammerstein's. How did you come to put those two songs together? Because it just seems like they were meant to be together.
Yeah, great question. So before, we were doing an arrangement of Send in the Clowns. That was our tribute to Sondheim. And while I loved the arrangement and I loved the song, it just didn't feel like Jewish Broadway. So we were, Mike Stapleton, the music director, and I were doing the show in for the University of Indiana's Hillel back in March. And I had just been to Israel a couple weeks earlier, and the campus encampments and were really starting to take off. And I live, you know, I live in Manhattan, so I'm close to Columbia, and it was terrifying. It was a very scary time to be a Jew in New York and to be a Jew on college campuses. So I knew that there is incredible power in having the students in the audience feel seen. And I wanted to talk about, you know, we talk about in the show Pillars of Judaism, and one of those pillars is studying and education and also what we pass down from generation to generation. And so I talk about, you know, if you want to understand how these two things intersect, look at the relationship between Sondheim and Hammerstein.
Mm.
And then I say, you know, we're seeing a lot of hate in the world, specifically on college campuses. And I'd like to believe that the people on these college campuses weren't born to hate. You've got to be taught to hate and fear. And then we go into the arrangement. And it just made sense. And then, as a cautionary tale to the adults in the room, like, we, if it's true that you've got to be carefully taught, then we have an obligation and a responsibility to be careful with the things that we say, because children will listen to us.
Mm.
It feels like Sondheim wrote the epilogue to You've Got to Be Carefully Taught.
Yeah, yeah.
You have to be carefully taught to hate and fear. And if that's true, then we as adults have to be careful with the things that we say, because children will listen.
Yeah, it's such a delicious number to hear, because it sounds beautiful.
Right.
But the words themselves, and if you take that context of the two of them, and what they meant to one another,
right?
It's something, you know, you could write a book about, you know, just those two songs and these two men and,
right,
and what this what these two songs mean. You know, there are a couple of other numbers on the album that are just so delightful to hear. You know, Cool from West Side Story, just, you know, it sounds cool. Shy from Once Upon a Mattress is such a delightful thing to hear, and I'm sure that must be fun to perform, is it?
It's very fun, and it's fun because I am in no way a shy person. So it's nice to kind of play with the audience and be like, you know, this is just a bold-faced lie. I am not shy at all, but God, do I love singing the song. And with Cool, you know, what you can't see on the album, but you can see in the show, is that I'm actually playing the conga. So in the show, the conga is just on stage the whole time. It's there. And Cool comes towards the very end. It's actually right before the final number. And so it's just living up there. And I'm sure that people stare at it and go, why is it there? What's happening? And so there's always this moment that, you know, I take off my jacket and I roll up my sleeves and I take off my watch. And then I go and sit down at the conga to kind of create this tension among the audience. Like, what is happening? What is he doing? At no point in the show, if it's someone's first time seeing me perform, would they have any idea that I grew up playing the drums. They'd have no clue. And then I just sit down at the conga. I don't say a word. And we start. And then it erupts into this arrangement that's on the album. So that moment you can't quite capture, and there's no real way to convey that. But I'm playing conga on the album. But that's how the arrangement for that came about, and that's why we even thought to do that song in the first place in terms of the show. It was, you know, how do we highlight this thing that is, you don't see very often. You don't see a person sit at a conga drum and sing. Certainly not with Bernstein at the same time.
Yeah. You know, to go back to the beginning of our conversation today, to hear this as one track, if you will, to sit down and listen to it from beginning to end without, you know, getting up from my chair even. I didn't know that you studied the drums, and I would think that the rhythm of percussion probably plays something into how you perform even today as when you're singing. I mean, am I drawing too long of a connection, say?
No, you're not at all. I love rhythm. I think there's rhythm in comedy. I think there's rhythm in speech. It's why I love language. It's why I think my love for music really stems from a love for rhythm. And as a kid, I could not sit still. No matter what I did, couldn't sit still. I was constantly tapping my foot, tapping, you know, on my legs. But when I, and my real introduction into the Great American Songbook, yes, was, you know, listening to my Bubby hum Some A Chance at Evening and other standards, mm-hmm. you know, while she was making matzo ball soup in her kitchen. But also, I grew up playing along to Frank Sinatra singing, not as a singer, as a drummer. So then to come back to these songs as a singer and with the curiosity of, you know, what's he saying? Why is he saying it? What is happening texturally, rhythmically? How does the music and the lyric, how does it line up? How is the orchestra supporting it? I wasn't just listening to a singer sing, and I wasn't just listening to the lyric, but I had spent so long focusing on the rhythm section that I already had this inherent awareness of the orchestra. So I can't help but try and figure out how these two things come together. And then for me, as a performer, I believe that the lyrics are the thought and the music is the emotion. And so when I listen to a song and I'm listening to what they're saying, I think, okay, that's what they're thinking. And I listen to what the melody is, but also to what the orchestra is doing to support the thought. Oh, that's the guts. That's what's being felt. That's the visceral quality that's happening, that's propelling the reason to sing. I don't know that I would have had the awareness to even listen in that way to the orchestra had I not first grown up listening to the drum part and the bass
yeah.
and the rest.
Yeah, and that's how we should really listen to music, isn't it? Because, I mean, I mentioned the 13-piece orchestra on this album. It's just wonderful to hear you with them and you know, when you know there's a bridge, for example, to hear them play, hear the band play, and hear all 13 pieces. If you listen carefully enough, you'll hear them. It just makes experience so much better. Ari, I can't tell you how grateful I am that you're doing this, and I really appreciate it. Break a leg, as they say.
Thank you for having me. This has been a joy. I really appreciate it.
The website for more is at ariaxelrod.com. The concert at 54 Below is this Saturday night. 54below.org is the website for tickets and information for that. The album is called A Place for Us, a celebration of Jewish Broadway. It's from PS Classics. Ari Axelrod joined me on the line from New York City. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.